Hello, and thank you for listening to this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. Welcome back if you are a regular. I hope we are managing to keep you entertained week by week. Stay tuned as we are going to be trying out some different ideas and formats later this year. Lots of surprises coming your way. And if you are a newbie, then you are very welcome. I hope this one proves very entertaining as well. And if there's something you feel the need to share, by all means, get in touch. mark.ward@securityforum.org is the address for any comments, ideas, or requests to join in. We'd love to have you on here. This episode is about a perennial InfoSec issue. That's the finding, the hiring, the managing of people. We'll be talking about the struggle to find the right people in the first place, how the workplace should support them once they do arrive, no matter their background, attitude, and capabilities. And we have just the right folks to explore that issue, folks that have found, grown, and overseen teams of all shapes and sizes, managers and mentors. We've got them by the bucket load. My name is Mark Ward. I do research at the ISF and joined the ISF from the media, where, to be honest, management was generally a case of shouting and pointing. Sometimes you had to hit a deadline. Sometimes things were happening. People had to be coordinated on. But it was also a place where people reveled in the title of the nastiest man in journalism. No, really. A lot of a very strange trade and some very weird attitudes towards people management. Our first guest to help with this conversation is Keith Price, who's currently Chief Security Officer at the UK's National Highways Agency. Keith, hello, welcome.
Thank you, Mark. Good to see you again, Paul.
Good to have you, Keith. So you worked in quite a broad range of places. So yeah, I was just curious about sort of the management styles you've seen, because I know you've done quite a lot of time in the military. So yeah, I guess you've seen a lot of changes.
Yeah, in the military, my specialty was I would be sort of parachuted into underperforming units. Typically it was due to challenges the leadership was encountering, poor leadership, quite honestly, was usually the case. And so things, you know, morale and welfare was being impacted, quality of life was being impacted, and the units weren't performing and getting the mission done. So I was part of a small team. I traveled around 27 different countries over 20 years. And 8 times out of 10, the leader in question would be open, you know, to some coaching and some help. And the 2 times out of 10, we promoted them to the Pentagon. So there was always a solution at the end of the day.
Promote them out of the way. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I'm surprised, to continue that, because I would have thought the military would be quite resistant to change, but I guess not.
Well, in the Air Force, we were probably the least military of all the branches.
I see.
In fact, in the early 90s, when I joined, I was sent to Toyota to learn lean as a young airman. And so that was totally outside my comfort zone, but also hugely impactful on the rest of my career to date. So very thankful for the way that the Air Force treated the military more of a business than the traditional military branch.
Yeah. Just to bring in Paul Watts here as well, a regular on the podcast and someone who's put teams together from scratch a few times. Well, that must have been hard work. But are you surprised what you're hearing about the military from Keith, Paul?
I'm always surprised with what Keith has to say. absolute pleasure to be here. Keith, good to see you as well. Have you built any roads yet?
I'm working on the one outside my house first, and that's selfishly, but no. And funnily enough, I do view security at highways as an enabler to that end, right? So my mission is not to secure the highways or the systems responsible for the highways, but it's to enable safer and better journeys for the 4 million daily users of our strategic road network.
All right. Okay. That's quite a name. Because I did wonder about the sort of highways agency, how and what security you do. I mean, I guess it's not stopping. It's not the highway code and things like that, is it? There's a lot of other assets out there you're protecting.
There's a lot of OT. I mean, there's a lot. We call it things that get wet is how we classify our OT estate. And it's, the top 10 of our critical services reside in that OT space. And I'll admit my experience with OT is limited to my time in the Middle East, working with customers and clients in the oil and gas industries there, and then renewable energy here in the UK. But it's quite interesting, because quite often in cybersecurity, we feel that we can, you know, in the OT space, as an example, we can send cybersecurity professionals into an OT environment and they can become OT SMEs. quite honestly, the reverse is true. And the sooner we realize that the OT engineers and architects and so forth actually already do security, we just need to help them gain a voice, I think we'll do much better in that OT space.
You're right. Yeah, I think, Paul, because you used to work on the railways, I believe, didn't you? So I guess you've worked with a lot of stuff that gets wet too.
I did. I was at Network Rail for 4 years as their CISO, and probably went through a very similar journey that Keith's going through on the railways. And the principal priority of the railway was everyone home safe every day. So, you know, the differentiator, I think, from working as an IT practitioner where we worry about confidentiality, integrity and availability is, from an engineering perspective, it's all about safety, reliability and performance. And those members who have read Mr. Holland's recent research will show how those two things can intertwine with each other. And it does provide some interesting conversations. Always, engineers always fascinate me, and they were always less than fascinated about me saying I've got to patch stuff when they're used to hitting it with a hammer. So, you know.
It's a different kind of patch. You hit it with a hammer.
Very much so.
Yeah. But I just wonder, because interesting you mentioned about the critical infrastructure side of things, because one thing I did want to touch on was stress in terms of the stakes of getting it wrong in InfoSec. I mean, does that make it the most stressful occupation? I mean, I guess there are other ones like brain surgeries. I mean, but I just wonder, yeah, is it endemic to InfoSec stress?
Well, they're never going to let a CISO do brain surgery. Let's say that. that would end badly. Oh, so not even go there. Different types of stress, I think, is the right answer there. And the motivators of stress in the security industry come down to a lot of things: workload, complexity, anxiety, fear of the unknown. You know, and there are probably more. The problem with security is no 2 days are ever the same, so you're not quite prepared for what's coming down the road at you, for want of a better expression. I don't know what your views are, Keith.
For me, so I'm a security operations guy. You know, if you give me an incident, you know, I'll spend the next 14 hours on it and fully energized in the team. It's almost like Star Trek Enterprise. You know, everyone's got their little part to play, and it all feeds into the overall success of defeating the Klingons. But give me a 1 day notice that I have to present something in front of the board. Oh, my stress levels and anxiety go through the roof. So, as Paul says, to each their own in that world. And when I talk security operations, those are the folks that I see the vast majority, you know, dealing with day-to-day stress, because, you know, if they get it wrong, and in their minds, they're constantly probably thinking of this, if they get it wrong, it could be disastrous for the whole company, you know, the whole business. And if they're an MSSP, it could be disastrous for multiple organizations. So, those blue teamers and those security operations folks, they're the ones that I typically worry about as a CISO. But I have other teams. Security architecture is another good example. And it's very much like a roller coaster ride. You know, security architecture is kind of like professional services. You know, beginning of the fiscal year, when everyone's got a ton of money and there's a lot of projects, everybody wants their piece of security architecture. Right. So the stress levels are high. So again, it can be very time limited. And when I think about my time in Deloitte, you know, we're looking at ways to measure stress in other business units and how we can help protect them. Right. I look at tax and audit in Deloitte in the 3-4 months of the year where they're really busy. And, you know, you throw a phishing simulation at them, it's not fair because they're probably not going to pass it. So as CISOs, we have to think, how is stress and anxiety impacting the whole organization, not just our cyber teams, and how we can help to support each other.
All right. Yeah, that's a very broad view of things, because I guess I'm not sure I did think that InfoSec was more stressful than other places, but that's because I've chatted to quite a few CISOs who look pretty stressed, and I think they were suffering as a result of that. And I guess a big incident or something could really ramp up those levels. And I think as well, there's quite a few security folks who see themselves as the conscience of the company in some respects and feel like they have to take that on. I don't know, Paul, because I know, Paul, you've written about hero culture. I mean, is that a manifestation of that?
It, You find situations sometimes where security leaders feel like they are burdened with the pain of the rest of the organization, and they carry that burden like a sack of bricks slung over their shoulder, and they drag it around with them. And it can feel a little bit like that. The problem with risk management identification is once it's been seen, it can't be unseen. That risk, that opportunity for threat and peril has to be discharged somewhere. And if it can't be discharged into the business, that burden remains with those risk and security practitioners. And that can build up over time. So, that can cause a bit. The hero culture is an interesting one. You know, some of our number, like Mr. Keith Price, get a kick out of running a security operation and fighting an incident. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we go looking for trouble, right? But sometimes we do go looking for trouble. But if you haven't got somewhere to then put that trouble once you've found it, you know, there's your problem again, really. So it's an interesting one, the whole hero conscious. Most of the time, security leaders have got enough workload to worry about without going foraging around to try and find more.
Yeah, but presumably the hero culture, one of the many bad sides of that is that people try to do it alone. And I think what you were saying, Keith, is that it's about the whole flight deck. It's not just about the catching in the chair kind of thing. It's everybody has a part to play.
Yeah, something that I've had to learn, a hard lesson. So my time in the military, 25 years, and I'm a technical CISO. I come from IT. I understand technical problems. But coming into the private sector, I didn't as well understand business problems.
Okay.
And so as a tech CISO, I have to sort of stop myself from trying to, from getting too much into the weeds now, right? Have faith and trust in my teams that, it's their day, daily bread. It's what they do day to day. And to instead concentrate on those bigger business problems. So that has been a difficult journey in the last 6 years since I've left the, military. But I do see the value in it. And I see the value in it in the military, too. And I think we could probably do a lot better. And I talk to, I've got guys and gals on my team who are ex-British forces, and they say the same thing. It's sort of something that's missing from the MOD is this way of looking at things in a non-technical way. And, when we describe risk to, general officers, they sit there and they nod their head. And if they were CEOs, their eyes would be rolling into the back of their head because we don't explain it well. But in the military, there's kind of just this acceptance. Okay, let the security people talk how they want to talk and we'll get on to the next agenda item. Whereas in business, you get put at the end of the agenda and nobody cares.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
You do see sometimes as well, and I've called this out a couple of times now, where we can be part of the problem in so far as some behavior of some security leaders is a control issue where we just don't feel that we can trust and relinquish some of that responsibility to other people. So we carry it around. We try and do it ourselves. Now, that serves two negative consequences. The first one is you will drive yourself to an early grave, number one. Mm. Number two, you're never going to create a high-performing team because that team will feel that you don't trust them. And therefore, that cohesiveness and that empowerment that you want to give that team is going to be incredibly hard to build when you're not giving them the opportunity to learn, to succeed, and to fail. And when they fail, you catch them when they fall. That's how it works. That's how we learn. If you're not doing that, you are creating an issue for yourself right there.
Yeah, that's interesting about being able to fail as well, because certainly that getting it wrong is quite a difficult, because throughout school and everywhere you're taught to get it right, and there are consequences for getting it wrong, and maybe that's but it's interesting you say about trusting them, and I guess that's part of being a good manager is creating that situation where you know you can trust them, but I guess that's hard to do for a lot of people.
And that's another thing we deal with in our profession is we only use risk in the negative sense. We're inherently attuned to hearing the word risk and immediately recoiling or thinking, what's the problem? No, instead, we should also be, maybe not as equally, but in some measure, looking at risk as a moonshot chance, right? So we can potentially, and this goes to what Paul just said, empower our teams to take those positive risks that could have huge payoffs. You know, I'm thinking now, of course, where AI is everywhere. How yeah. can we, you know, what's the moonshot use of AI and security that's going to, you know, save us, you know, build efficiencies or save X amount of time and effort in the SOC as an example. So, and then, you know, if you take that risk and you fail, you're still going to learn something from it. And as a security leader, you have to be the one that takes and owns the responsibility and accountability for the failures and it, more importantly than really the successes. The successes you should be giving to the people below or across from you that are enjoying, you know, and delivering those successes.
Yeah, this is something that we have to remind our community of practice of on quite a regular basis, that not all risk is bad, to your point, Keith. And we talk about this in the first leadership paper on business value and security. If you look at risk through a singular lens, you're not thinking about the other variables in the business outcome equation. So if you're, the example I used in the paper is you're a startup, you're a couple of years old, it's all about building market share, it's all about speed and agility, and you are prepared to break some eggs whilst you're making that omelette. Now, if you're in there gung-ho and you're just trying to manage and eliminate all risk, that's completely counterintuitive to that outcome. So risk yeah. practitioners do have to take a step back and understand what it is the business is trying to do and understand where those variables all need to be set. Because actually, some risk, as long as it's informed and managed risk, is good for business. And it's not just about managing it all out of the way. And I think, you know, again, one of the things I always say to my teams are, if you don't understand the business in which you work, then you need to just press pause and take some time to go and learn, because you're not providing anything constructive to an organization if you don't understand what it is and where it's trying to go, right? Not yeah. all risk is bad. Take that.
Well, that's a great point around the startups. How many startups actually engage with a security professional in the beginning? They don't.
No.
Because we're seen as a speed bump to success.
Yeah. We had a colleague who went off to work for a startup and their policies were written literally day by day and usually by incident. So they suddenly had to write one for, please don't ride your scooters in the corridors, because that was, you know, they were bumping into people, and it's sort of, that's the kind of thing that they have to cope with, I suppose. But yeah, you're right, it is seen as a drag. But equally, I think there is that desire to iron out risk, but it is quite healthy, because, you know, organizations are inherently risky. I mean, that's the whole point. That's why they do it. You know, it could go horribly wrong, but generally it doesn't. And that's the sort of the reason for doing it, isn't it?
Yeah, low risk is usually low return. So, I mean, if you want to be in a safe, environment and you have sort of a monopoly, but somebody's going to come up behind you. So there's always somebody coming up behind you ready to steal your thunder. And you know, you have to always be innovating. You have to always be thinking about how you're going to improve delivery to your customers. You know, what can you bring that the competitors, you know, are nipping at your heels about? So, you know, I think where I'm sat now, I have the luxury of being in an arm's length body where I don't have the commercial aspects to be concerned about, but I have efficiency and how I deliver that quality and that security, which leads to safety, which makes me a good custodian of UK taxpayer dollars, pounds, and also makes me someone who is responsible for, again, ensuring that safety and efficiency of the strategic road network. Because from a CNI perspective, I'm not what I would call a juicy target, but the things that go across my highways to those other CNI partners definitely are.
Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah, you're a useful conduit. For all those kind of things. Yeah.
Have you ever been described as a useful conduit before, Mr. Price?
No, that's a new one. I've been called many things in life, but
called
a useful idiot.
I meant the network. You're a useful conduit for the bad guys.
In terms of
the data and other, you know, if they can get it, the stuff you control, well, not control, the obviously.
Yeah, you know, sure. A lot of folks, you always see, well, China and this and that. I says, well, where do you think they learned it from? To be honest, if China wants your stuff, they're going to get your stuff. It's not a case of if, but when. And so, again, this comes back to the discussion around resilience. Yeah. And it's not more important than anything else. You know, we could talk about resilience and compliance and security and in different discussions. But for me, resilience is when the worst happens, how well we recover, how well we address, you know, attack what's coming our way, and how well we, you know, restore business. More importantly, in my mind, actually, than preventing something. Because, you know, for me, whenever I started a new job, my first port of call was to go to teams that would help me recover the business in the worst case scenario and see where they were at. It's a pessimistic view, maybe, sure, but it's one that served me pretty well. And I look at my last organization, they brought me in after a ransomware attack. But from day one, I said, look, I'm here to, you know, assuming that another ransomware attack is around the corner. And these are the things that we need to look at to help mitigate when it happens again. Thankfully, it didn't. But and to Paul's point, the hero, I think the hero thing, it can also be a negative in that it makes us a bigger target to those attack vectors, right? So an example, there was a Forbes list released last week, the top 200 most secure businesses in the world. And I'm like, I'm glad I'm not on that list. Because as a criminal attacker, it's like hold my beer moment, you know? Oh, really? You're in the top 10? Let's see what we can do.
It is refreshing that we've seen a subtle change in language in boardrooms. It's not completely changed, but I remember some of my early engagements very early on in my career when you go into the exco or into the board and they barely lift their heads up to ask you that stupid question. So Paul, are we secure? And you know, a little piece of me died inside and I thought, wow, how am I going to answer this? Nowadays you do get this, okay, we're going to get walloped. It just needs to be the smallest wallop that we could possibly can. To Keith's point, we've just got to bounce back. So how do we make ourselves resilient? And actually, that language is really changing from secure to resilient. And that is, I would like to take some credit for that on behalf, not me personally, but our community. But I'll take it now. But, you know, it means that those messages have kind of, they've started to sink down. They've started to percolate. They've started to become an institutional risk that we just have to deal with. Whereas before it was always it will never happen to us. Just like organizations that didn't invest back in the days in disaster recovery or business continuity, it will never happen to us. And then when it did and they couldn't trade and they couldn't bounce back, it was everybody else's fault. Let's go and fire the CISO. Let's go and fire the risk manager. Now there's a bit more of a sense of camaraderie and like, okay, we're in this together. So what do we do to make ourselves resilient? At least we're starting to have those conversations. Now, of course, I haven't mentioned more with less, which is the CISO's biggest bugbear. You know, we are expected to run faster and faster and faster and faster. And the capital and the operating expenditure that's made available to us for the most part is lower and lower and lower. We have challenges with workforce. We have challenges with skills. We have challenges with, you know, uncertainty. You know, all of these things conspire to make this a really exciting job and a terribly frustrating and anxious job all at the same time. What's not to like about our industry?
Yeah.
Put that on the posters. I'm sure you get a lot more people recruited.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Come on, be frustrated with us as well. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, but I think it definitely changed. I mean, just writing about breaches and things in the media, it was very much a case of, in the early days, you were hunting for the people that had been hit. And then towards the end, it was, who copes with it best because everybody's been hit. And it was, you know, that first conversation with the press office, you knew exactly how badly they'd been hit because if they were all over the place, they didn't have a hope. But if they had the statement and they knew some details and they could tell you more than you could tell them, then sure, they were in a good place. And it was kind of interesting how that changed.
Well, we're talking about hiring challenges too. I see many colleagues, and I've done this in the past too, where we'll spend 18 months trying to find that unicorn that we need or we think we need to help us, run a program or, engineer something. But I found in the last few years that it actually pays off sometimes to hire, like a fresh graduate or someone who's just moving over into security and developing them into the skill set that you need. So someone asked me, if you could hire professions outside security, who would you hire? And I said, teacher, accountant, statistician, and psychologist. Those are the four industries that I would hire from, because they have the mental mindset to address these risks and security problems and issues that we have in security without the biases. So yeah. it's about having, for me, it's about having a well-rounded team. So it's not, you know, I can't just go out and hire all graduates. That would make no sense. But also, I think as CISOs, we need to look at the workforce a little bit more fairly, right? We shouldn't demand certifications. We shouldn't demand degrees. We shouldn't demand 5 to 7 years experience for an entry-level role. We're hurting ourselves. We're losing sort of reliability within the profession. You know, when right. folks, you know, at the entry-level spectrum say, I can't find a cyber job. How do, and as CISOs, we go, well, you know, earn your dues by working the help desk and then do this. It's not really fair. And it's, you know, some of it rings true, but I think we could do better as leaders and also do better in preparing our replacements. We don't do that either very well in cyber as CISOs. Nah. We basically say, go out, this is your job, do this 9 to 5 or 24/7 if you're in operations. And when they come to us and say, I want to be a CISO one day, what do I need to do? Well, yeah, let's talk about that, you know, next week for 30 minutes. That's not fair either. Other professions are much better at developing their leaders of the future than we are.
Yeah, I saw an article this week which suggested that gamers and roadies would be good recruits for InfoSec. Gamers because problem solvers, they're, you know, very familiar with a lot of technology, and roadies because they're good at coping with crises. I think it was just kind of interesting pool to pull from.
I think the reality is, if we go back 10 or so years, sticking a number in the air, it was still a very secular, closed domain. Right. We had servers in data centers. We could go and cuddle them occasionally. We knew where everything was. It was all quite benign and quite structured, and it was all very, very technical. All users were idiots, and we thought for them, and life was good, right? That was the reality. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but that was kind of the reality. And then technology and user experience came screaming past us and ran off into the distance. And we went, what the hell was that? I don't know. Don't worry about it. Keep patching stuff. But the reality is now the consumer gets technology. And we have shifted radically towards how technology helps businesses go to the next level. The trouble is we're still back in the data center playing with Cat5 cables and pieces of tin. We've got blind spots. We're not very creative. We're not very good at thinking creatively outside of the box, all this businessy stuff. We're not great with numbers. We're not good at, because this is just stuff that we didn't instinctively or naturally have to do as we were growing up through our IT careers. So fast forward to 2024, there is a reason why businesses are screaming for business-aligned security experience, because they want people who can think firstly about the business outcome, the journey, the destination that we're trying to get to, and then show and demonstrate how secure, resilient technology will help the business get there. Whereas we're sitting there trawling through a standard of good practice or an ISO manual saying, well, we need to implement these controls and 8-character passwords and this, that, and the other. And actually, we're just not aligned to the same journey and aspiration that our businesses are on. Now, in order to fix that, we need a broader portfolio of skills. Now, when I go to the universities and do guest lecturing, which I absolutely love doing, by the way, you talk to people coming through, you say, what do you want to do? And they go, I want to be a pen tester. Like, no, actually, to Keith's point, we need accountants, we need artists, we need creative people who can augment the technical skills and really help us be that body of knowledge and practice that businesses really, really want. It's naive enough of us to think that it's still a technical domain and that's all that we need. It's just not true. So you need that diversity of skill set, and you need that diversity of a type of person to work in cybersecurity. But we're not very good at marketing ourselves in that way, right? We're still seen as the very technical sort of people.
We're on the techie end of it. Yeah, but we've talked to quite a couple of ISF members who have recruited much more widely and specifically gone to some of those places, some of those courses in colleges and universities, and saying, would you be interested? And people are like, InfoSec, what's that now? Isn't that just, you know, the guys in the basement or the girls in the basement? And I think there's a mutual journey of understanding that has to be gone on with that. I say, no, it's not all that. And actually, you could do this and you could apply that. And they've had some real successes because they've had some very different people come in and go, oh, yeah, like you say, it's difficult and interesting every day and frustrating. But yeah, there's some very good problems to solve and challenges. And yeah, it is much more attractive than they thought.
Well, I think we've just recently realized that cyber is a people issue. And as Paul says, we're the kind of people here who sit in the basement office, you know, hoarding our stapler. it's not a good look. And folks in, you know, MBA CISOs, as we say in quotes, are more successful because they, you know, they bring about the relationship is in first, relationship's important first. And they hire the technical SMEs to surround themselves and make themselves successful in that area. Whereas the tech CISOs, you know, I had to go back and sort of learn business formally and informally. You know, I went and found some CFO mentors and so forth who said, look, you know, the measure of your success, Keith, will be where you are positioned on the board schedule. If you're at the end every month or quarter, nobody cares. If you're before lunch, you're winning. You know, if you're on the agenda before lunch, you're winning. And same goes across the business with my stakeholders. If I'm being invited to lunch for, you know, to talk about things and get advice, or if I'm being invited to their business unit team meetings to have interactive sessions or to say, you know, this is what security is doing in the business and how we're doing it under the hood. That's the metric of success that you should be shooting for, not necessarily how many vulnerabilities you patch within X number of days. You know, that's the minuscule things that help you be successful, but they're not business concerns, really.
No, they're not the top thing you should be mentioning, I guess. No.
I use an analogy. I've used it a couple of times where I think, I say the good old days, forgive me, because, you know, we have a range of ages. Back in the days when all this were fields, I used to run into the boardroom with a spreadsheet full of answers to questions that had never been asked. And I'd say, we're eradicating 90% of all spam email, and we've got, you know, 25% of our estate is up to date. And the people looking back at you got glazed expressions on their face saying, what's this got to do with me? Where's the relevance of any of this? What you want to do is go in there and have a conversation. Even if that conversation starts with the question, are we secure? Well, it depends. Let's talk about the definition of the word secure. What you want to have in your back pocket is answers to potential questions. What you're trying to do is have a conversation. And actually, it should be, how can I help? What's in it for me? It's basic stuff. You want to sell something to somebody, and what we're trying to do is sell a vision of good security in an organization. There's got to be something in it for the person who's sitting the other side of you. So just firing numbers into the ether doesn't do anything. How do those numbers contribute to the company's EBITDA? How do these contribute to the speed of getting the next great product out of the door? What's your contribution? And it's just a change in the way that you approach trying to engage with these people. And yeah, you know, Keith says, if you get in their early doors and it's not to get shot because of the latest breach, then you're absolutely winning at life. If you're, I mean, the number of times you've been told, right, you're on at 3, and then 3 becomes 4, 3 becomes 5, 5 becomes 5:30, and then you're let in and they're already putting their coats on. You know, and I got one guy's got, I've got half a sleeve on, you know, he's got his eye on his first pint, and they're going, can you make it quick, Paul? Like, you got 5 minutes. You had an hour and a half's worth of material, and now you're screwed because you don't know, well, what's the most important thing I need to tell them?
Yeah.
It's just, yeah.
Well, it's about building that. We talk about hiring diverse teams. For me, because I don't have the, you know, I don't have the compensation that I can compete with the private sector, I have to build the brand of Highways and my security functions, my teams, to attract talent. And we talk about diverse talent. We also rarely talk about neurodiversity, you know, disabled folks. And so we have to build positions and roles that cater to their needs, right? So an example, I've just put a part-time role out at Highways. We filled it, and it was a 20-hour role, work from anywhere at any time. So I'm thinking neurodiverse, disabled folks who can't commit 40 hours in an office, parents who are still raising their children who need maybe a little extra financial security or want to get back into the profession or get into the security profession. So the person we hired was a school teacher. And again, they're working in my cyber education awareness, and they've brought some ideas from their life as a school teacher that completely blow my mind. Whereas a guy like me, when I, you know, if you ask me to deliver cyber education awareness, I'm phishing is bad and, you know, clicking on links are bad. And people are like, nobody cares, Keith. But she brings, you know, this energy, and my whole CEA team, my education awareness team are like that. They're, you know, they're not really cyber people. They're teachers.
Yeah, I guess that's what you want to get to, isn't it, though? You don't want them to become cyber people. You want them to be much more diverse. And again, we've had similar kinds of things. AXA was talking recently about some interns they had who, you know, one of the first things they were working on was newsletters from the InfoSec unit to the rest of the organization, part of their sort of education and awareness. And the guy doing it was like, what is this? This doesn't even make it. It's not, well, they were in French, but, you know, it doesn't read well. I mean, how on earth do you expect people to understand and take this on board? So he rewrote those, and yeah, it's been massively successful. They've really changed that part of what they do as a result. So yeah, it's useful stuff.
It's interesting, just coming back to something that you said there, Keith, where you said, where's the effect of, I can't pay private market, so I have to think about my brand and my proposition. I think a lot of people that you talk to now coming into the industry, it's not just about the numbers. So I completely relate to that. If you go and work in an organization, the salary is obviously important. Let's not be around the bush. Of course it is. But equally, it's the sum of all of its parts now. Are you going to train and develop me? Am I going to feel empowered? You know, what's my contribution to the greater good? One of the things that always stuck with me when I worked on the railway, and I'm sure that people at highways feel exactly the same way, was something that I felt in a lot of my other organisations, but I never felt it more than I did when I worked at the railway. And it was, I know why I'm here. I know why this is important. I'm relating to this on a practical and an emotional level, and I want it to succeed, and I get it. And that's really important. You know, you've got to connect with the role. You've got to connect with the profession, but you've got to connect with your role within the profession, the job that you're doing, on a number of different levels. And we should recognize that when we're trying to develop. The other thing, as you said, and I love the story about your CEA team there, is that diversity of different people brings a diversity of different ways to solve a problem. One of the mistakes I made in an organization, sorry, I've told this story a million times before, was we were the suits trying to sell security awareness. We were writing it for people that we knew and understood. But the organization I worked in was very diverse, different roles and different walks of life. And, yes, you know, the communications people who came in and said, you're doing this all wrong, said, if you don't know your audience, you're never going to relate to them. You're never going to connect with them. And that's the sort of thing that instinctively doesn't come well to a group of techies. And it just comes back to that earlier point of why we need that diversity of skills and people to really enrich what it is that we're trying to do.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. So I think if we have a way to summarize this, then we're all about challenging people. We're looking for diversity as well, aren't we? Look beyond cyber. And I guess as well, I don't know, final thoughts from you both. Look after yourselves. I guess the CISO is kind of tip of the spear. So yeah, make sure that you have the support you need as well, because it can be a very stressful place. And in any incident, yeah, you're going to feel a lot of stress and trouble and worry.
Yeah, it's this has been used a lot. This metaphor of, you know, putting, you know, you're in an airplane and putting your mask on before helping others, and we are terrible at it as CISOs, and I'm guilty. And you know, from a mental health standpoint, in one of my more recent leadership roles, I found that, or I felt that I'd failed my whole team. It really brought me down. Mentally, I was shattered. And it really took, I went and saw a counselor, and this counselor said, look, you are taking the weight of the world on your shoulders, trying to do it all silently, because you have this fear that if you show vulnerability that you'll lose credibility. And that's not the case. And it was really hard for me, you know, especially as a military person, having that background where, you know, if, you know, you take care of your people, you take care of them at all costs. And that's what I had done, you know, in the military and in some austere, you know, places ending in Stan. I did that. And I never realized that by not also looking after myself, my not just my mental health, but my physical health, which is, you know, over COVID is we've all had a lot of challenges with our physical health too. That has a direct impact on how well, how resilient our mental health is too. So it's for me, I actually, when I talk about things at conferences and cyber conferences, I talk about people things, mental health, hiring, developing teams. Cause for me, that's the, you know, that's really the area that I'm most passionate about.
It's something that we don't do very well, just to build on that is, yeah, major incidents, you can be working day and night for days on end. And we as leaders will do our level best to make sure that we've got rested teams and that they're rotated in and out. But the number of times I've been in that situation and actually nobody's looking after us, for the reasons that, you know, you've kind of suggested there, Keith. You know, I've been involved in major incidents where I've done sort of 20, 25 days and just been completely broken by the end of it. So you worry about looking after your teams. I think, as you said, Mark, something that we do have to do is really make sure that we're looking after ourselves as well. And there's lots of different ways that you can do that. Most organizations have support in place. But equally, don't be afraid to look to your own communities. The CISO community is very good at supporting each other, actually. And you don't have to look, and this isn't a good thing, by the way, but you don't have to look very far to find another security leader who will empathize because they've been on the same journey, they've had the same experiences, and they've suffered the same levels of stress and burnout and mental health deterioration. And you can lean on each other. There's a couple of colleagues in the industry, a guy called Sab Sembi and a gentleman by the name of Paul Sims, who are working very hard on the Mental Health in Cybersecurity Foundation, just trying to pull all of this together. One of the things that I'm really hopeful with that foundation is that we will look at that leadership tier as well, because as you absolutely nailed it, you know, Keith, you know, you've got to make sure you put your oxygen mask on and then look after everybody else, because if you do it the other way around, bad things happen, and that's not great, right?
Yeah, no, they agree. I think, yeah. Thanks, Keith. Thanks, Paul. Overall, the message is then: look after yourself, get the support you need, and let's be careful, because obviously it can be very stressful out there. You can now find ISF podcasts on all major podcast platforms. Look for our page on Audioboom, where you can subscribe to make sure you don't miss an episode. The podcasts are also available at securityforum.org, where you can also learn more about ISF research, tools, and guidance.